transfer it to the port of Ashdod in the south of the Palestinian-occupied territories. The destroyer was towed to Ashdod because the Israeli Navy's main base at Haifa was within the range of the resistance movement's missiles, so the Israelis fully evacuated the port.
The 33-day war almost led to the elimination of what we formerly knew as the Israeli Navy. When you refer to the data available on Israel, including satellite images, you see no sign of Israeli vessels, neither in Haifa, which is the Israeli Navy's main hub, nor in Tel Aviv and their entire Israeli marine borders. You see no Israeli Navy vessels, neither close to the Lebanese borders, nor in the vicinity of Palestine. You will find no trace ever of the two-star class destroyers and the Israeli frigate that accompanied them.
Hezbollah's military command created a unique and advanced anti-naval force with the help of land-to-sea missiles. Hezbollah used the capability three times during the war, and they surprised commanders of the Israeli fleet, who closely pursued the battle every single time.
The key question is how such a destroyer can be targeted by a guerrilla group. The main issue is the highly confidential technology used by the units that prepared for the attack and fired the missile. As technologically speaking, launching a missile toward such a target is no easy task. The Sa'ar 5 incident shattered the dreams of many world countries that looked up at a vessel as the apex of the technology used in their own Sa'ar 2, 3.5, 4, and 4.5 destroyers. How Hezbollah forces managed to do that? While they are not even a naval force or an organized coastal guard, they are rather a group of ordinary people with a will to fight, who were secretly trained and secretly advanced towards the enemy, dealt a blow and withdrew, without ever being identified by the enemy. That was realized despite the enemy being equipped with satellites and unmanned drones, which provided it with the entire picture of the situation during the conflict. These brave people managed to beat the enemy despite the fact that targeting of the destroyer was no easy task.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah ended his speech, and Beirut was filled with joy as people took to the streets to watch the burning destroyer at sea.
In every war that you may be going to wage against Lebanon in the future, if you besiege our ports, the entire fleet of your military, civilian and trade vessels heading toward Palestinian ports in the Mediterranean will come under fire by the Islamic resistance.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. the limelight. Evidence suggests that committed foreign aid is being redirected from peace-building programs into efforts to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, and is likely to have ever more of an impact on the ground than a decrease in foreign aid. A further reduction in funding and troops for United Nations peacekeeping missions is also likely. We have prepared for you an article written by Eleanor Gordon. Eleanor Gordon is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled "Peacebuilding Suffers During Pandemic Obsession." The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Eleanor Gordon's article. Resources critical to peace building and to countries vulnerable to conflict have been significantly reduced as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. In conflict zones from Ukraine to Syria, hundreds of thousands of people are suffering in silence. These conflicts risk becoming forgotten crises and are intensifying as states and non-state armed militant groups utilize the pandemic and a distracted international community for their own strategic advantage. The figures are alarming. For instance, according to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, foreign direct investment collapsed in 2020, falling by as much as 42% to an estimated $859 billion, compared with $1.5 trillion in previous year 2019. Many humanitarian organizations have also recorded a dramatic drop in donations from private individuals and fundraising activities, or expect private donations will decline as the global recession hits. Profound cuts to foreign aid are anticipated as countries continue to invest heavily in COVID-19 related activities whilst facing severe economic recession. Already several governments, including the British government, have announced major cuts to aid budgets in light of COVID-19. A decline in public support for foreign aid, typical in times of financial crisis, is also likely to encourage cuts. This in turn is likely to have a negative effect on peace building, which is already underfunded. Evidence suggests that committed foreign aid being redirected from peace-building programs into efforts to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic is likely to have been more of an impact on the ground than a decrease in foreign aid. For instance, Britain, France, and Australia have announced a reorientation of their aid commitment to medical infrastructure. A further reduction in funding and troops for United Nations peacekeeping missions is also likely. This is in turn predicted to reduce the capacity of peace operations by about 30-50% over the next year or two. A global survey of organizations engaged in peace building was conducted to assess the impact of these cuts on the ground. In the survey, 62% of participants said they or their organization had experienced a reduction in funding for peace building work. In addition, 75% of those who took part in the survey said COVID-19 had or was likely to have had a negative impact on the financial security of their organization. Other global surveys have had similar results. Reduced funds will also inevitably affect employment and job security for these organizations. The survey found 74% of those who took part felt their work was more precarious, whilst 56% knew of someone in the sector who had lost a job as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. On top of this, 75% said The focus of their work had changed. They referred to strong signals given by donors to pivot activities towards COVID-19 related issues, even if other needs were perceived to be more urgent. The reduction in resources comes when they are most needed. This is because COVID-19 and its effects, economic shocks, unemployment, extreme poverty, and vaccine inequalities worsen conflict situations. These negative impacts are likely to intensify as the coronavirus pandemic persists. After a short decline after the pandemic was declared in March of 2020, conflicts in several countries increased again. This notably often takes the form of violence against civilians by state forces and militias. Escalating insecurity has already been witnessed in several conflict zones, including in Syria, Colombia, Somalia, Yemen, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Afghanistan, the Philippines, and Myanmar. As states and non-state actors and various militant groups exploit the pandemic to their own strategic advantage. Many of the ceasefires declared in response to the United Nations Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire in March of 2020 have fallen apart. COVID-19 has exposed weaknesses in global governance, especially in terms of preparedness and threat mitigation. To address these weaknesses, countries need to invest in preparedness, to be aware of the complex interconnectedness of security threats, and avoid knee-jerk reactions to singular risks that divert attention and resources away from longer-term threats. There is also a need to communicate more effectively to the public about how aid budgets are being spent. This includes stressing how aid programs benefit donors as well as recipient countries, given public opinion can be a key factor in determining whether aid budgets are reduced. The increased risk of armed conflict as a result of the diversion of resources and attention towards the COVID-19 pandemic has global repercussions. So too does the difficulty in controlling COVID-19 within conflict zones and beyond their often porous borders, until a widely accessible vaccine becomes available to the most disadvantaged people in the world.
Inside Israel. The social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But of course, we know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities such as, for example, Bnei Brak. As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence and increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short term, which relates to the corona. The long term is the attack on institutions, mainly by Netanyahu, over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. Recently, the people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. So you can see the results in the decline of trust, and in the short term relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor, and just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat, and we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, and we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years, no wonder people lose trust. And when they lose trust, this is very dangerous. So I agree, this is a great, great danger to Israel, the internal crisis, the internal feud. First of all, there's all division between secular Jews or non-Orthodox Jews and Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. This has a long history of there's a community that pay less taxes. They don't study the core issues like math and English, etc., which are necessary to modern world. Many of the men don't work, and they don't serve in the army like all of us. I served, my children served, and my granddaughter now is in the army. So to look at a community that doesn't take part in the national effort is very infuriating. Come the corona, and you see these people defying the orders of the Ministry of Health, and they are getting infected. I think the Israelis would have accepted anything if they had leadership who would tell them, you know what, everybody has now to pay something. People who can, people who make a lot of money should have paid, should have been taxed to help others survive this. But you need leadership for this.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Shimon says, an economic and social crisis in Israel. No services for welfare for 2 weeks. Leo says, Israel starting war to cover the economic and social crisis in Israel. Thousands of Israelis renewed weekly demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for the long-serving Prime Minister to resign over corruption charges against him and his alleged mishandling of the coronavirus crisis.
Israeli public, it has no belief in its officials, in its government, in all the how do you call it, the government, the offices. There's no belief in them, in non-belief. The police is enforced, is using extra power for on children, on elderly, on just people that are in the streets, on one hand, and on the other hand, other people do whatever they want. Nobody believes anybody anymore. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. And the thing is, why the people went down to the streets is because of the disbelief. And what a lot of people, not all of them, but a lot of people are saying, we do not want to go back to, it's in Hebrew, it's called the state, the old state, the old good state of Israel. We do not want to go there because it wasn't good for a lot of us. It wasn't good for the Palestinians. It wasn't good for the Mizrahim, it wasn't good for the Ethiopians, it wasn't good for a lot of people, basically. It wasn't good for the poor. So basically, I think people are saying, we want something that is completely new. We don't trust any of the politicians that are changing parties from, you know, they've been in this party and now they want to go in this party and now they're separating and they're combining. Most of the public does not believe the public figures in Israel almost anymore. There's no trust.
The The effects of the political and economic crises and the strength of their negative effects largely stem from the way they were managed. Israelis blame the regime for the mismanagement of the coronavirus crisis. Opinion polls have recently showed the existence of a loss of confidence in the regime, Israel's leaders, and institutions. This loss of confidence has negatively affected the Israeli population's readiness to implement anything the regime tells it. Businesses, including restaurants, have failed to adhere lockdown procedures. The poll also shows that most Israelis support the continuation of the demonstrations and protests. This even in the backdrop of their deteriorating economic and social conditions. This is, of course, a huge threat to the Israeli regime. The demands of the protesters have begun with the downfall of Netanyahu, but these protesters have went on to ask for the dissolution of the cabinet and Knesset and a fourth election. In December, their demands are met. Now, with a fourth election set for March, the weekly anti-regime protests still continue with more people joining. A recent survey by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 83% of Israelis believe that there is no social solidarity there. According to this poll, 74% of Israelis say that they do not trust parliament, that is the Knesset, and cannot rely on it in the face of the pandemic. 70% do not trust the cabinet, 63% of them do not trust finance ministry officials, 51% of them do not trust the police, and 47% do not trust the Ministry of Health.
Is not a politician. A statesman thinks about the future of the country and what's good for the country. The politician thinks about the next election and what's good for him. And what we see today, we have politicians. We don't have the statesmen. We don't have the people who give us a vision. Just think about the Israelis today, they don't have hope. There's nobody they believe in who can speak to them and tell them the truth. If it's hard, Israelis know to go through hardships, but they need leaders, statesmen, to believe in. And we don't have these people right now. So let's see what happens in the next elections. I believe, I look at the protest. The hundreds of thousands of Israel taken to the streets, and there are some people who are doing it for week after week, you know, in cold weather, rain or shine. And I know many of the young people who go to the process, and I see a lot of potential there. So, and also I'm a sworn optimist, so I believe that we will see a new generation of people emerging out of this crisis and taking over. I think Israelis want a direction. Israelis are willing to go through a lot of hardships, but show us where we are going. If you look at the, for example, the handling of the current corona crisis. The businesses are closing down. People are laid off. I don't know if they when the corona goes away, they will find any job anymore. And in the meantime, our leaders throwing money like from the helicopter on everybody, people who need it, people who don't need it, with no any plan of how we make a crisis into an opportunity. For example, strengthen the public health system. The reason why we survived this crisis is because we have Kupot Cholim, we have the public health organization, which are so strong and so accessible to the public. Look at the vaccination, how well it goes, because we have all those organizations which have been shrinking over the years because of lack of funds. And suddenly we have so much money to throw on everybody instead of investing in in the public health system.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Sir Distick on Twitter says the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that individual members of the Israeli security forces, in the course of their response to the demonstrations, killed and injured civilians who were neither directly participating in hostilities nor posing an imminent threat. Yehi asks, what about the demonstrations against Bibi, the ones going on for months all through this pandemic? Jankowski says thousands of Israelis renewed their weekly demonstrations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him to step down as Tel Aviv went into third COVID-19 lockdown. Since last year, Israel has been witnessing demonstrations everywhere.
It's a mistake to think that the public was out in the streets only to demand that the government will be dispersed. And it was a mistake, and there's also a mistake. A lot of people think that the demand is to interrogate all kinds of things, like the selling of the submarines or the buying of the submarines also to Egypt or to whoever. I'm not too involved in that issue. I think some of the public is out there saying we want a government that is not corrupt. But a lot of people are out in the streets, or a lot of people are not out in the streets, but basically they feel that they do not want to go back to business as usual. They do not want any government. And also there's something I didn't mention, because on the last elections, one of the Kahol Levan party received a lot of voices. They received a lot of people voted for them, and the hope was that they would send Netanyahu to trial or home, basically. And they sold the public. They went into coalition with the Netanyahu government. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. The people feel that the vaccinations, a lot of people are happy to take them, but a lot of people feel that the vaccinations, the fact that Israel has been receiving so many vaccinations, people feel that Israel is like, is the government is allowing people to be, the companies to do experiments on people here in Israel. So basically, the sense of disbelief is tremendous all over. And actually, when you look at what's happening around in Israel, you see the Palestinians for 48, talking Umm al-Fahim and cities within Israel. It's an uprise now. They're in the streets, there's police, children of 14 years old are being arrested violently. You have these collisions with the Bnei Brak, with the Orthodox cities. You have it almost everywhere. Israel is extremely in unrest all around. There's nothing, you know, we've been out in the streets for 30 weeks now in Balfour in Jerusalem, but not only there. So basically, there's a big the society is in a situation of unrest. And also people feel that the fact that they're going to elections in the fourth time in 2 years, it's the feeling that there's no government. There's no head of police, there's all kinds of positions that are not occupied because Netanyahu is not, the government isn't functioning.
It Israel has lost control of coronavirus for several reasons, the annual strategic assessment of Israel said. The most important of which is the loss of internal political stability and the failure of the Israelis to respond to the instructions of their regime. To this day, much of the Israeli public believes the coronavirus is a natural disaster, mainly due to their distrust of the regime. But it is important to note that these issues only shed light on underlying crises that have been ignored. Now, the social problem is a national and strategic security threat for Israel, one that has shaken the highest echelons of the regime.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين سيما بقية الله في الأرضين خيلي خوش آمدید آقایان محترم بعد از یک سال تقریبا
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent and the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. You are very welcome, honorable gentlemen. I am meeting with you almost after a year, but I wish I could see you in better circumstances, that is, speaking to you up close, but the present circumstances do not allow it. I wish to congratulate you on the birth anniversary of the Imam of the Pious and the Commander of the Faithful, God's greetings and peace be upon him, which is in 2 days, and also on the birthday anniversary of Hadhrat Jawadul A'immah, greetings be upon him. A number of good brothers, dear friends, and outstanding personalities in the Assembly of Experts passed away in the course of the past year, and we ask God to forgive them. They gave me a list of all the deceased in the fifth term of the Assembly, but I will not read the list as Mr. Raisi mentioned their names.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
خداوند انشاءالله درجاتشون رو عالی کنه و جزای خیر به اونها بده و ما رو موفق بداره که قدر این چهره های برجسته علمی و عملی خودمون رو بیشتر بدن.
I hope that God will raise their status, bestow rewards on them, and help us fully appreciate the value of these outstanding personalities in scholarly and pragmatic areas. I have prepared 2 points to discuss. One is about an ideological need of society, which will be good to discuss at this meeting because of the presence of ulama and scholars. These statements are in fact addressed to Islamic seminaries and scholars in seminarian, academic, and other such environments. Another issue concerns an international political matter, which I will discuss after that.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to
Around the World with Reporters.
Nowruz is the most widely celebrated holiday in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It means new day that marks the first day of spring. The holiday, which usually falls on or around March 21st, is widely celebrated across the West and Central Asia. Iran's foreign ministry invited the envoys of the Nowruz region to mark the event. Held in the presence of ambassadors, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif congratulated the arrival of spring.
On dar sinas.
The lesson that all must learn is that there is only a superpower in the world, and that is the Almighty God. There is no other superpower in the world. Those who were boasting of their military, economic, and scientific power all were defeated by a tiny virus.
Iran's Minister of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts, Ali Asghar Mounesan, and Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Mansour Ghulami, also attended the ceremony and made a short speech. Mexico's ambassador to Tehran said, Nowruz is very similar to traditions in Mexico.
La verdad es que estoy muy, muy conmovido.
Nowruz is very interesting to me. Few people in Mexico know about this celebration. I see a very happy atmosphere in Tehran, especially since you are apparently entering the new century. Another thing that caught my attention is the human relations that take place during the Nowruz celebrations, which is very similar to the celebrations in Mexico. For example, the whole family goes shopping for New Year here, and it is the same way in Mexico.
Some traditional musical bands from across Iran performed some pieces for the visitors. A half-sin sofra was also set in the iconic Mashq Square to mark the festivity of Nowruz. The message of Nowruz, which is revival and a new life, was also projected on a historic building inside the ministry complex via video mapping. Over 300 million people celebrate Nowruz across the globe. In Iran, it is the most important holiday that marks the beginning of the new year. Nowruz has been celebrated in Iran for over 3,000 years. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know someone was, a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum. Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Based on a report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 100 civilians, including women and children, were killed or wounded over the last 6 days alone. The rights body called international community to put pressure on both warring sides, mainly the Taliban, to reduce violence.
As our findings show, 13 civilians, including women and children, were killed and 93 others were wounded due to rising violence across the country only over the past 6 days. Therefore, we seriously call on the international community and other rights bodies to do whatever they can to put an end to misery of war-weary Afghans.
This comes as both the Afghan government and the Taliban accuse each other of targeting civilians, but facts on the ground show that terrorist groups such as Daesh and Taliban are responsible for much of civilian casualties.
There are multiple reasons in civilian casualties, such as terrorist attacks, the proxy wars, or unknown elements that are still in equations. But the war in Afghanistan is as complicated and bloody as ever. People are still dying, life is still being torn apart, and the nation, global powers, most importantly, the people of Afghanistan are being drawn further into a situation that is hard to see ahead of it.
However, the NATO troops are also accused of targeting civilian gatherings, such as wedding parties and religious events. This comes as despite all political attempts to bring stability to Afghanistan, this is the Afghans who rarely bear the brunt of violence. Local Afghans say they welcome any agreement that leads the country to calm and security. Afghan civilians lose their lives on a daily basis while the country's peace process is going to enter a new phase. The launch of separate summits in Russia and Turkey to discuss the fate of the peace process. Will those conferences bring peace to Afghanistan? Let's wait and see. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The US and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose US policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia has led a US-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On March 13th, then-United States President Donald Trump declared the coronavirus to be a national emergency. 1 year later, many believe that the world's richest country has had the world's worst national response to the pandemic. At over a half million fatalities, the U.S. has twice as many deaths as the second-hardest-hit nation, Brazil. Many attribute that to the U.S. being alone among developed nations in having an almost entirely for-profit healthcare system.
It's been an extremely tough year, which is atrocious for the richest country on earth. You know, China and much of Southeast Asia have managed to control the virus. Much poorer countries, Australia and New Zealand, which are, you know, English-speaking capitalist countries, have managed to contain the virus. So the U.S. response is, you know, from the government's really pathetic at this point.
The U.S. emulated China's example by calling for lockdowns, but they came without the governmental safety net nor the cultural solidarity which such mass quarantines seem to require. The resulting economic and personal devastation is still too enormous to be fully grasped, but the lockdowns clearly penalized the lower classes the most, caused inequality to soar, and resulted in the nation's worst economic situation since the Great Depression. The virus hit poor and non-white communities disproportionately hard, and then when the U.S. developed vaccines, these communities have been disproportionately excluded from receiving them.
A major reason for the poor U.S. response is, you know, how decentralized and dysfunctional the system is. And on the other hand, the lack of, you know, a militant, independent working class movement to really fight and demand those things that people in other countries are getting. If we had that sort of militant working class organization, we could have made those demands. The ruling class, the capitalists, would have probably conceded more.
The pandemic came amid, or maybe contributed to, major social protests towards racist policing, a bitterly disputed presidential election, and the hardening of unprecedented social divisions over the past year. The United States has pinned its recovery not on making structural changes, but on the vaccines that they have been able to produce. Should the vaccines fail to prevent a third major corona wave this spring, the resulting socioeconomic and cultural disaster would reach uncharted territory. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As Farrell J. Dino, these words sound meaningless to ordinary people, but to every thalassemia patient, they are lifesavers. In fact, they're the drugs that chronically transfused patients use to remove excess iron from their bodies. Otherwise, they would die. According to experts in this conference in Tehran, Iran needs to import 17 million doses of these two drugs annually to supply its thalassemia patients. But only 2 million doses make their way into the country. The problem is U.S. sanctions. According to Iran's Thalassemia Society, since the U.S. reimposed sanctions against Iran in 2018, 187 thalassemia patients have lost their lives simply because the bans denied them access to life-saving medicine.
Since the U.S. reinstated the anti-Iran sanctions, 7,000 of them have lost their access to necessary medicine, and many of them have died.
Thalassemia patients are not the only victims of U.S. sanctions. People with EB, which is a severe skin condition, are also faced with drug shortage. Hadi is among the 800 EB patients in Iran, to whom sanction is an unending nightmare.
One in every 50,000 people contracts EB, which is known as a barfly disease, so it's a rare condition, and so is its medicine in Iran. We're constantly on the lookout for the drugs to arrive, or else painful blisters will develop on our skin.
U.S. sanctions do not directly target Iran's medical sector, but the banking sanctions make it impossible for Iran to pay for any medical item it would buy from foreign firms. World leaders have time and again called on Washington to exempt humanitarian supplies from the list of its anti-Iran sanctions, but to no avail.
U.S. sanctions are inhuman and illegal. Washington says it is targeting the Iranian government, but they are targeting the Iranian people.
Iranian human rights officials say U.S.'s rights violations against Iranians has been kept under the rug for decades. The bitter reality, they say, has come to light during the coronavirus pandemic, when American officials continued the ban against Iran.
Medical supplies and food cannot be banned. It's a violation of all international laws to ban such items. But unfortunately, we see that the U.S. and EU have continued their illegal sanctions against Iranians to achieve their political interests.
When it comes to the COVID vaccine, the World Health Organization has launched the so-called COVAX initiative to ensure fair distribution of vaccines across the world. Officials here believe a similar initiative needs to be put in place by the WHO for other pharmaceuticals to ensure equal access to life-saving medicine across the world. Far from any political agenda.
Hadi is one of the countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions against Iran. Rights activists say the ultimate solution lies in the hands of world leaders to avoid holding innocent lives hostage for their political gains. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full, and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities are growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections.
The number of patients exceeds the capacity of hospitals, in particular, the capacity of the oxygen generators as well as the beds. We've opened new wards as the situation has deteriorated, but the wards open and the numbers continue to rise. We're at 100% capacity in general, even at 110% capacity in some hospitals. That's why there's